5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello. Is it? Do you prefer Willie or Robert?
It don't matter.
That's the voice of Robert Picton. Before his capture, he never had a sensational nickname. There was no citywide manhunt. He was simply known by the name he used in life. Pig Farmer Willie. Three years after this call, Picton will die in prison following a violent encounter. Officials describe it as, quote, a major assault. He's airlifted to hospital, but passes away days later on May 31st, 2024. The first thing I ask him is simple. What do you want people to know? Picton's version is that he's innocent, but it's clear. He is responsible for the deaths of an unknown number of women. He was charged with 26 counts, and investigators found the DNA of many more across his 28-acre pig farm. At one point, he even suggested to an officer that the true number could be much higher. The truth is, we'll never know how many victims there really were.
So just to be clear, you didn't kill anyone.
That's correct.
I'm James Buddy Day. This is Unmarked. When I spoke with Picton, there was no doubt in my mind he was guilty. But I gave him some rope because I wanted to keep him talking.
How do you feel when people say that you're a serial killer?
Well, what can I say? What can I do? What can I do? Just because the police might mark me down as I was there.
He speaks with calm detachment. Though much of our conversation is rambling, incoherent thoughts drifting in and out of meeting.
And they kicked me out of camp, and they said, boy, you must agree, sir.
I stay with him. Maybe he won't tell me everything. Maybe he can't. But the story matters.
People say you're a monster.
Well, what can I do? What can I say?
Behind Robert Picton is a system that failed. Years of police inaction and missed opportunities that allowed a predator to operate unchecked.
On behalf of the Vancouver Police Department, I would again like to say we are sorry to the families and friends of the missing and murdered women. We could have and we should have caught Picton sooner. And we're committing as police officers to do everything we can, working with our community, to make sure a tragedy like this does not happen again.
The story takes place in British Columbia. It's the westernmost province in Canada, perched just above Washington State. It sits at the northern edge of the Pacific Northwest, a region of endless forests, cold rivers, and sprawling wilderness. It's beautiful country, and the perfect place to hide a body. Robert Picton is born on a pig farm in Port Coquitlam, a small community outside Vancouver. He's the middle of three children. His older sister, Linda, is sent to live with relatives in the city before Robert's even born. From an early age, Robert and his younger brother, David, work the farm. The brothers are filthy, they reek of manure, and they're constantly ridiculed at school. Robert even earns the nickname Stinky Piggy. I asked Picton, and he recalls those days as brutal.
I worked in the field all day long from 6:30 in the morning to 8 o'clock at night, and 8 o'clock at night to midnight.
When I'm speaking to Picton, he is standing in a communal phone location inside a maximum security prison. He's yelling into the phone, I'm yelling into my phone. It's difficult to understand what he says at times. But I want you to hear him. I want you to hear his voice. And we will post this entire podcast with transcriptions on our YouTube channel.
That's what it boils down to. Right down to, they can't find a judge to take my case. Seriously. That's very true. 100% true.
As a child, Robert's relationship with his parents is distant. His father is abusive, largely absent. His mother, Louise, is hard, controlling, cold. When things get bad, Robert hides.
On some level, it was just a really horrible, perfect storm of powerlessness and...
That's Detective Schenner. Years later, when women begin to go missing from Vancouver's east side and no one pays attention, Schenner is one of the few who refuses to look away.
Whether it was his mother, whether it was that his mother didn't protect him from his father, I just don't know.
When Robert turns 12 years old, he has one tender connection, a small calf that he saves and raises himself. One day, he can't find it. He asks his mother to help, and she tells him to check the barn.
His dad had slaughtered his prize calf, his pet calf, and he was devastated. And even in the, you know, in the interrogation, he was in his 60s, and he was still, to that day, he was devastated by that, and that his dad would do that. And he felt, and that was kind of, he said, when he started to learn how to slaughter animals himself.
When I talked to Picton, I hear the same dichotomy. The man who took so many lives feels nothing for the people he killed. No empathy, no remorse. But when he talks about animals on his farm, his voice changes. He fixates on them. These are pigs and hogs and calves that have been dead for decades. But it's one of the few things that stirs emotion in him, and it's telling.
After when they took everything over, they never fed my animals, they're nothing. I babysit for almost about 7 months, 6 months. And she gets to the time where she's going to have babies. And they don't care for nothing. And I can't go on the property, I can't feed them, I can't do anything with them. I can't do nothing.
That's Picton rambling about these animals. But for Picton, they're not animals. They're objects of control. That's what he's attached to. Back in 1967, Robert's brother David Picton is 16 years old. He's driving their father's truck and strikes a teenager named Timothy Barrett, who's walking along the side of the road in Port Coquitlam. David flees the scene. He drives home and he tells his mother, instead of calling the police, his mother drives him back and allegedly rolls the body into a ditch. They then go home and say nothing. The injuries from the accident are severe, but they're not fatal. The coroner discovers that the boy drowned in a nearby puddle after the crash. David Picton is eventually convicted in juvenile court for failing to remain at the scene. He loses his license until he turns 21. David remains a sore spot for Robert Picton, and when I ask him about it, he says they haven't spoken in more than 20 years.
The police told me, Donna says I can't talk to him. They said, we don't allow two suspects to talk together.
David Picton has never been charged in connection with Robert's crimes, though speculation has followed him for decades. In 1978, their parents both die, and the farm is passed down to all three siblings. Linda, the Picton sister, wants nothing to do with it. David takes the house, and Robert moves into a trailer on the property and takes over the farm. This farm becomes Picton's refuge and his prison. As Picton recalls, the farm became empty, and he would go days without speaking to a single person.
Nobody's in the farm all day long. Nobody. The farm is empty. You can drive in and out of there and everything else. There's not a person, not a soul there.
By the mid-1990s, David works in construction and salvage. Robert becomes a local butcher, still raising pigs on the farm. When he needs to dispose of his animals' remains, he starts visiting West Coast Reduction, a rendering plant on Vancouver's east side. That's when he starts spending more and more time on Vancouver's Skid Row. It's a 10-block stretch known as the Low Track, a neighborhood of poverty, addiction, and survival sex work. This, again, is Detective Jenner.
You walk those two or three blocks into the downtown east side from any direction, and you're in, you know, just what feels like a war zone of really dispossessed people, mentally ill people, people with a lot of physical injuries and ailments, just addiction issues, crime, filth. I mean, it's just, it's hard to describe when you haven't been there.
In 1986, World Expo turned Vancouver into a global showpiece and accidentally created the perfect environment for a predator. The year before, the city had evicted hundreds of low-income residents to make room for tourists. When the visitors arrive, sex work and drugs explode, feeding a black market economy that never goes away. It's there that he starts offering women rides, money, and drugs. And then he starts bringing them home.
Did you know the women personally? Any of them?
Even when the evidence is overwhelming, many psychopathic offenders will minimize, lie, and deny any connection to their victims. It's a pattern of habitual deceit. It's about positioning themselves as the center of gravity in their own personal story. I press Robert Picton to talk about these women, talk about these interactions, but the only person he's willing to talk about is Gina Houston. Gina isn't one of the missing women. She's a longtime friend of Picton's, and later, she'll help the RCMP arrange an interview with him. When he brings her name up, he lights up.
Gina, my truck. So because she was pregnant, the problem is, so I lent her my truck, and she stayed in a truck for about 7 months.
He talks for several minutes about all the wonderful things he did for Gina, as if lending her his truck redeems him somehow. But despite his denials, we know where Picton was spending his nights. By the late 80s and early 90s, Picton is a regular in Vancouver's downtown east side. The earliest victim investigators can connect to Robert Picton is Nancy Clark, a sex worker last seen around midnight on August 22nd, 1991. She didn't return home the next day to care for her two daughters, who were 8 and 8 months old. Her DNA will later be found on Picton's farm. Two women go missing in 1994, two more in 1995, three in 1996, including Tanya Hollick. She's 23. She's last seen on October 29th, 1996. Her family searches the east side for weeks before they report her missing. Police close the case almost immediately. According to the police report, the lead investigator writes her off as, quote, just partying, saying she probably left to avoid taking care of her infant son. Years later, her DNA is found inside a freezer at the back of Picton's workshop. After Tanya's disappearance, 16 more women vanish in the next 2 years. 16 from a neighborhood that once averaged one a year in the decades previous. Yet, the Vancouver police do almost nothing. There's no database, and only one officer is assigned. There's no question Picton killed many of those women. DNA, bone fragments, personal effects, they were all later recovered from his farm. But according to Picton, he has no idea what happened.
I haven't got a clue what was going on. Like I said, even my DNA is not even there. Nothing.
The evidence says otherwise. it's more denial from Picton to maintain control. It's March 23rd, 1997. Picton picks up a sex worker named Anderson in the downtown East Side and takes her to his farm. This again is Detective Schenner.
Picton had picked her up on somewhere in the downtown East Side. He took her to his farm. She wanted to leave. And he wouldn't let her leave. She picked up a knife and she cut him across the neck. Then he grabbed the knife from her and he cut her straight up sort of the midsection.
Anderson runs from the trailer, clutching her abdomen.
She was, holding her organs together. She flagged down a young couple out on a date in their car.
The couple drive her to safety, flag police, and an ambulance rushes her to hospital. What they don't realize is that Robert Picton has been admitted to the same ER for stab wounds. When police search Picton, they find a key in his pocket. It's a key to the handcuff still attached to Anderson's wrist. She barely survives. Picton is finally arrested. When I press Picton about this, his answer is unsatisfying. He claims he was framed, that the police told Anderson what to say.
The police has told them what to say. It's not what they want to say, it's what the police have got them to say.
In 1997, Picton lies just as badly to police, but it doesn't matter. The charges are dropped. I have a review of the case written decades later. It reads in part, "The Anderson case was stayed because of her perceived lack of dependability due to her drug dependency. Police just don't believe what's right in front of them. And because of that, Robert Picton walks free and kills again and again and again."
If it had been a murder, it would have been a slam dunk murder conviction. So this idea that Anderson wasn't credible because of her addiction was shocking to me because, coming from the downtown East Side, if every victim in court was considered not credible because they had a drug addiction, there would be nobody in court.
By 1997, more than 30 women are missing. Most are sex workers, most have drug issues, and most are Indigenous. In Canada, Indigenous women are the most vulnerable population. And unlike other groups, they're more likely to be victimized by men outside their own race. Frustrated by inaction, a local resident named Wayne Lang creates a website and a 1-800 tip line for information about the missing women. One day, Wayne gets a tip from a day laborer who works on a pig farm in Port Coquitlam. We track down Wayne, still living in British Columbia.
I ended up getting a phone call from a guy by the name of Bill Hiscox, who had worked for Willie Picton. Bill told me that Willie had been charged with stabbing a girl in 97.
Hiscox tells Wayne that others on the farm have seen evidence in Picton's trailer that cannot be explained.
They were talking about women's identifications, women's clothes, some with blood on them, being in Willie's trailer. You should see what that guy has in his trailer. That information came secondhand to him.
He says Picton jokes about killing women and says he feeds their remains to his pigs. Wayne brings this information immediately to police. Another opportunity to stop Picton.
And I never heard any more about it. That was the end of it.
They dismiss it as nonsense. A farmer feeding people to pigs? Police say it's too ridiculous to believe. But Wayne doesn't stop. He goes public, and soon the media starts asking questions about the missing women and the police silence. This is when the Vancouver police assigned Detective Lorimer Schenner to investigate.
I had a weird sense when I took the missing person job. In fact, probably a weird sense when I got into policing that at some point I was going to be working on something big and that was going to be really difficult. I don't know why, I just always had that sense. Did I think it was going to end up being the largest case in Canadian history? No.
In August 1998, Detective Schenner takes charge of the missing persons files. He's one of the department's brightest, and he's about to uncover what others refuse to see. Detective Schenner now sees Picton as the top suspect. He tracks down the day laborer who called Wayne Lang's tip line.
It was hard for me to find Bill Hiscox. He was in detox or in jail. He was hard to reach. I did get in touch.
When I asked Picton about it, he's dismissive of Bill Hiscox. Ironically, he calls him a nutcase.
He's a real nutcase. You can't believe anything that's coming out of his.
Picton rambles about Hiscox for a long time, and it's telling. Psychopathic offenders often develop an intense, almost obsessive fixation on the people who inform on them, and it's because informants create these real-world consequences, which is something psychopaths rarely anticipate. It's through Bill Hiscox that Detective Schenner learns another name, Lynn Ellingson, a single mother and friend of Picton's, who allegedly witnessed him disposing of a body.
We got a tip in July 1999 that a woman had seen Picton skinning a woman's body that was hanging in his slaughterhouse. Lynn Ellingson was the person who witnessed this in the barn. She was one of, I guess, several friends, mostly women, that would sort of hang around Picton. He would pay them to bring women to the farm, and he would give them drugs.
With this information, Schenner presses his superiors to act. It's another chance to stop Picton. The RCMP agree to bring Picton in for an interview, which takes place on January 19th, 2000, at the Coquitlam RCMP detachment. This is a portion of the actual interview later released in court in which investigators press Picton on the 1997 stabbing.
So you've never taken any of the prostitutes back to your trailer?
Not since this incident, no.
But before that incident?
Nope.
A comprehensive report from the Vancouver police later describes what happens in that interview, and I have a quote from it right here. Quote, "The interview is poorly conducted and largely unproductive. Picton denies killing sex trade workers, but gives an evasive answer about whether DNA from any of the missing women might be found on his property. The constables don't ask follow-ups. Picton consents to a search of his property, but that offer is not followed up on."
The RCMP just weren't taking it very seriously, and they didn't believe that he was a killer. And so this whole opportunity to further the investigation and get on the farm and search the farm was squandered.
Once again, police simply do not believe the witness, and they fail to go to Picton's farm and follow up on his invitation to search. We know now that if they had, they would have seen evidence lying in plain sight. I asked Picton about this years later, and he goes off. He says Lynn Ellingson was a drug-addicted schizophrenic.
She's a schizophrenic. She's heavy on drugs. She started herself on marijuana, and she went right into hard drugs.
More rambling from Picton. His psychopathy is on full display, and it makes me ask the question, how could any police officer sit down with this man and find him credible? Under mounting pressure and amid a growing body count, Detective Schenner suffers a nervous breakdown. He's removed from the file and submits a status report naming Robert Picton as the top suspect, though it's not followed up on. Meanwhile, a rookie RCMP officer named Nathan Wells gets a tip about illegal guns at Robert Picton's farm. Though he's not involved with the missing women investigation in any way, for the first time, he takes the tip seriously and applies for a search warrant. When he arrives on the property, he sees it in disarray. Robert Picton lives alone in a trailer at the edge of the lot. Nathan Wells goes there looking for guns and finds something else entirely. He sees an asthma inhaler prescribed to one of the missing women from Vancouver's east side, a woman named Serena Abbotsway. It's a serial killer's trophy. Inside Picton's trailer, officers recover handcuffs with pink fur, women's clothing, jewelry, night vision goggles, a bottle of Spanish Fly, and a .22 revolver with one round fired. Its barrel has been converted into a sex toy. Piece by piece, a disturbing profile emerges, setting off the largest investigation in Canadian history. Years later, when I asked Picton about this, he's concerned only for the trailer, which he claims took him 2 years to build. He's upset that the police leveled it. This is the same trailer in which he killed dozens of women.
I mean, they mowed down a brand new trailer that I just built. It took me almost 2 years to build it. And then they double wide mowed by home. Put it right over with a machine. And they left it there. What kind of shit is that?
The search of the Picton farm lasts for almost 2 years. Officers recover the heads, hands, and feet of Picton's final three victims from his outbuildings. They find 2 5-gallon plastic pails used for pig feed. Both are tipped on their sides. Inside are more human remains. The search becomes a nightmare. Crews bring in heavy equipment, including 2 50-foot conveyor belts. Soil runs over sifters. Fragment after fragment appear. Archaeologists join the team to identify decomposed and mutilated remains.
You know what the police told me? He said, whatever happens on your property, don't get involved. Like I said, I'm there, but I'm not there.
Picton is now in custody, and police now understand the pattern. Using money and drugs, Picton targeted women from the downtown east side, almost all addicted, many sex workers, mostly indigenous. The most vulnerable population in the country. Upon his arrest, Picton endures an 11-hour interrogation. He's shown photos of missing women, but he stays vague. He calls them pretty. He laughs off his involvement as hogwash. He calls himself a plain little farm boy. Investigators interrogate Picton, but get very little. Instead, the RCMP place an undercover officer inside of Picton's cell. On hidden camera, Picton brags. Picton tells the officer that he is, in fact, a serial killer who has killed more than 49 women and planned to kill one more to make it a, quote, even 50. He tells the officer that some of his victims' remains ended up in a rendering plant in Vancouver. He admits getting caught because he had become, quote, sloppy towards the end. I confronted Picton about this. If his claims of innocence are so legitimate, how did he know all the details to tell the undercover officer in his cell? For his part, he says that he learned all the details in his initial interrogation and that he was just telling this undercover officer what he wanted to hear.
Prior to the interrogation, I knew nothing, or very little. I told the undercover officer what's taking place, and nothing went ahead. I just shut it down. Shut it down cold turkey, that was it. There was nothing, I got the shitty end of the stick. Everything what he said is all lies.
Faced with this overwhelming evidence, the Vancouver police compile a list of 71 missing and murdered women in Greater Vancouver. Representatives from the First Nations Summit write letters and lobby leadership, initially submitting a list of 48 homicide victims of Indigenous ancestry. In the end, the search uncovers 60,000 pieces of evidence. Along with the undercover recording from Picton's cell, it's more than enough to take him to trial. On December 12, 2006, a jury is selected. They're told to prepare for a year-long trial. Picton pleads not guilty to 27 counts of first-degree murder. Ironically, one is dismissed for lack of evidence. And the remaining 26 are severed into two groups of 6 and 20.
I was taken for court many a time. Now there's only six state charges. The other ones are still alive. They're walking around. I'm not charged for them. Just because they were missing, they presumed it was the not if
For the first time, the women are named and heard in a court. While Picton's guilt is undeniable, as proceedings unfold, the defense floats an alternative. During the two-year excavation, police had recovered a massive amount of DNA profiles, 80 additional unidentified people, roughly half male. The defense argues the farm was a dump site for multiple killers, maybe even connected to organized crime. The prosecution acknowledges that a larger criminal ecosystem exists in Vancouver, but Picton is explicitly guilty.
So you don't feel like you got a good defense?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Picton is found guilty of the first six murders, but remarkably, no trial is ever held for the rest of the victims.
The interrogation went through and that was it. They shut the court down.
After Picton's initial conviction, the prosecutor stays all the charges, saying any new conviction would not increase his sentence. Some families are relieved that it's over, but most are enraged. They see another example of Picton evading justice. The case shakes the country. A public inquiry cites blatant failures by the Vancouver Police Department and, quote, a tragedy of epic proportions. Investigators point to a systemic prejudice against sex workers, drug users, and Indigenous women. The case becomes a landmark in the national crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women. In all, 67 women went missing from the downtown East Side. How many of them are Picton's victims remains unknown. After speaking with Picton, I came away with the confirmation that he didn't feel guilt or remorse. He only felt ownership about the farm, about the women, about the story. He was still trying to control the narrative decades later from inside a prison cell. But that's what psychopathy sounds like. It's the absence of empathy disguised as reason. And that's the person I spoke to. That was Robert Picton. If you go to our social channels, YouTube, TikTok, Facebook, and Instagram, you'll see additional content about this episode, more phone calls, insights, and interviews. And we'll be posting daily from the last decade of our true crime reporting. This season on Unmarked, you'll hear exclusive audio and interviews, calls, and content, including the last interview with Charles Manson. We're opening our archives one case at a time. Subscribe to Unmarked so you don't miss what we reveal next. This episode of Unmarked is produced by John Nadeau, edited by Dave Alderson, and our additional producers are Jesse Demaray and Steve McClellan.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.